Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Severe Segregation in New Jersey Schools conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. And if at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Friday, October 11th, 2013. And it's now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Gary Orfield, Professor and Co-Director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, it's an honor to have a chance to discuss some very important issues about the fate of New Jersey today in the release of two reports that are the result of a collaboration between the Civil Rights Project and the Institute for Education, Law, and Policy at Rutgers University, and Paul Trachtenberg, one of the country's leading lawyers on issues of educational equity. Civil Rights Project is a research center that was founded at Harvard 17 years ago, moved to UCLA in 2007, and has produced more than 500 studies of issues of racial equity since that time. One of our central interests has been the fate of the Brown decision that required desegregation in the country and found segregated schools to be inherently unequal. We've issued many reports and books on those issues, and we're now engaged in an effort to look in depth at all the states between Maine and North Carolina along the East Coast to see what's happened in recent decades. We have a fundamental concern with equal opportunity and civil rights, and a belief that sustained by massive research over the last 60 years that segregated schools are in fact inherently unequal, and the idea of separate but equal has never been achieved successfully on scale in any major part of the country. Many people think that desegregation took place and that it was unsuccessful. In fact, it took place primarily in the South, and it was very successful. It never took place in many parts of the North, and the segregated schools there have consistently been unequal in important respects. The data on segregation that we're reporting is extremely important because, in fact, segregation is related to unequal opportunity in many profound ways. Segregated schools have lower levels of competition, less curriculum, lower levels of graduation, less prepared teachers, more instability, they are the places where the dropout factories in the United States are concentrated, schools that are segregated not just by race, but by race and poverty. We are particularly focusing in this report on the extreme segregation that exists particularly in some of the urban metropolitan communities of New Jersey that is much worse than what the South is experiencing. And it has large consequences, not only for African Americans, but also for Latino students in the state. We're not saying in this report that desegregation by itself can end all the inequalities or produce paradise, but that segregation is unequal and that desegregation opens opportunities for all students, not just for minority students, in a state that's now becoming extremely diverse with four major racial groups and really has no policy to address these issues in any significant way. There has been no significant effort to desegregate schools through successful voluntary methods, methods such as those are used in some of the communities in nearby Connecticut, which has created desegregated regional magnet schools that are popular with all racial groups. Extreme segregation in New Jersey is in, ironically, schools that are the direct responsibility of the state. And it has been very interesting for us to work with Paul Trachtenberg in thinking through the implications of that. There are very positive alternatives to desegregation, and they are very important in a society which is in its last generation of a white majority and which really has to learn how to live and work together across racial and ethnic lines. Something you can't learn, really, in segregated neighborhoods with segregated schools. Good race relations and the ability to live and work together successfully as a society is something that we should invest in through voluntary methods that have proved to be successful in many parts of the country and are really being neglected in both in New Jersey and not being well supported by the Obama administration's education policy. We think that since separate but equal has been tried now for 117 years, never worked anyplace, we really ought to try something that has worked successfully and has been documented in 60 years of educational research. With that, I'm going to turn the conversation over to Greg Flaxman, who is the author, primary author of the report that's issued by the Civil Rights Project today, who to describe the basic patterns of spreading segregation in New Jersey. Greg?
I'll be sharing key statistics from the report on the current state of school segregation in New Jersey. The report draws from data from the National Center for Education Statistics capturing school demographics in the years 1989, 1999, and 2010. I'll touch on statewide findings, as well as findings related to the consolidated metropolitan area of southern New Jersey and the consolidated area of northern and central New Jersey. We'll be posting separate metropolitan summaries for these areas in addition to the main report on New Jersey on the Civil Rights Project website. I'll begin with a discussion on significant demographic changes that have taken place in New Jersey schools from 1989 to 2010. The state has witnessed a rise in the proportionate enrollment of Latino and Asian students, with the percentage of these students doubling as Latino students made up 11% of public school enrollment in 1989 and increased to 22% in 2010. Asian students made up 4% of New Jersey enrollment in 1989 and increased to 9% in 2010. Meanwhile, enrollment of white and black students relative to total enrollment has decreased in the same time span. The share of white students in the state dropped from 66% to 52%, while the share of black students saw a smaller decrease from 18% to 16% between 1989 and 2010. We've also seen racial enrollment shift to varying degrees based on urbanicity. White students have maintained the majority in suburban schools in North and Central Jersey, as well as South Jersey. However, in South Jersey, Latino students now make up the plurality of students in urban schools, with 42% of students in these schools being Latino in 2010, compared to just 26% in 1989. The majority of students in urban schools in North and Central Jersey were black in 2010, as was the case in 1989. School enrollment trends in New Jersey over the past two decades indicate increasing racial isolation for Latino students and a continually high level of racial isolation for black students. Current segregation patterns demonstrate that a greater number of schools in New Jersey are now extremely concentrated minority schools compared to 20 years ago. In 2010, 26% of black students and 13% of Latino students in the state attended apartheid schools, those in which white students make up 1% or less of enrollment. For comparison, in 1999, roughly 8.5% of Latino students attended these apartheid schools, meaning that the proportion of Latino students in the most segregated schools in the state increased by over 50%. The number of apartheid schools in New Jersey also increased by two-thirds between 1989 and 2010, from 4.8% of all schools to 8% of all schools. White students in New Jersey have remained racially isolated as well, with a typical white student in the state attending a school with over 70% white students in 2010. This despite the fact that white students made up 52% of enrollment in that year. The data also reveals stark economic isolation for New Jersey students of color. The typical black student and typical Latino student attend schools with a share of low-income students that is more than three times higher than the share of low-income students in the school of a typical white student. This income disparity signifies the presence of double segregation in the state by both race and class. These trends are also present in the North and Central Jersey and South Jersey consolidated metropolitan areas, although there is significantly less racial isolation for black students and Latino students in South Jersey than there is in North and Central Jersey. The proportion of schools considered multiracial increased from 10% to 26% between 1989 and 2010. These are the schools in which at least three of the major racial groups studied in this project, Asian, white, black, or Latino, are each represented by at least 10% of the student body. While this represents a positive step for school diversity, racial imbalance in New Jersey remained high in 2010, as the average school was 35% less diverse than the statewide student population. The report includes more detailed findings on the state as well as its major consolidated metropolitan areas. Policy recommendations at the close of the report address areas that could improve racial balance in New Jersey schools, such as affordable and fair housing, regional school district consolidation, and school choice options that emphasize desegregation. Now, Professor Paul Trachtenberg from Rutgers University School of Law will speak on the report released by the Institute on Education Law and Policy.
Thanks very much, Greg. I'm going to try to do very quickly four things. I want to speak for just a moment about the origin of the report about apartheid and intensely segregated schools in New Jersey that the Institute on Education Law and Policy produced. I want to equally briefly indicate some of the major findings. Third, I want to turn to the five recommendations. And lastly, something that's not in the report but I think it will have to be on everybody's mind, I want to talk a moment about the prospects that the recommendations of the report could be implemented, because they touch upon what we in New Jersey often think of as political third rails. Tragically, those often involve race. So let me start with the origin. I'm so glad that two representatives of the state NAACP will be on the program and will be speaking immediately after me, James Harris and Adrian Sanders, because the NAACP, both James and Adrian, others, have been meeting with me and others for some months, talking about the woeful state of school segregation in New Jersey and what could be done to alleviate it. Serendipitously, along came a request from Gary Orfield and Greg Flaxman at the Civil Rights Project that I review a draft of a report they were preparing about New Jersey. And I did that and was honored and pleased to be able to do it. There were a couple of findings in that report that really triggered the idea that a separate and more focused report would assist the public discourse about the state of school segregation in New Jersey. And the findings were mentioned by Gary and by Greg, but let me just mention them and highlight them. The two findings that caught my attention were the extent of apartheid schools in New Jersey, that 26% of all black students and 13% of all Latino students in New Jersey were attending apartheid schools, which essentially means their entire educational career will be conducted without the benefit of any significant number of white students in their school, 1% or less. The second number that was interesting to me was the changing overall demographics of students in New Jersey. It went from 66% white students in 1989 to 62% in 1999, and then dropped precipitously to 52% in 2010. So those kinds of numbers led me to a desire to dig in deeper on this with the help of Greg and Gary, who really are responsible for the data in the IELP report on apartheid schools. So the major findings, strong, without getting into the numerics of it, strong and to me distressing evidence of the extent to which New Jersey is two states educationally. You have old line urban districts overwhelmingly populated by black and Latino residents and students with a greatly disproportionate percentage of them poor. And then you have largely white or white and Asian suburban districts, often ringing the urban districts and having virtually no poor families or children in them. Secondly, the nature and extent of the segregation in New Jersey, in my opinion, violates New Jersey's constitutional requirements, both of a thorough and efficient system of education and of racial balance in that education system wherever it's feasible. New Jersey is singularly lacking in the juxtaposition of old-line urban districts and surrounding suburban districts for anything that could be called racial balance. A third element that I think had a particular bite for me and was a finding is that the Abbott funding and education reforms are being complicated, slowed down, and to some extent even undermined by the demographics of the so-called Abbott districts. That is, the poor urban districts, because they're almost entirely populated by poor children of color, present a series of challenges in the way of meaningful educational improvement that have made the funding and other successes of Abbott, I think, somewhat more problematic than they would otherwise be. And lastly, it seemed to me clear, and I think the report indicates, that the educational, social, and economic costs for the entire state are great and growing larger with accelerating speed. In the report, and I won't burden you because of time, with reading it, there's a quote from Chief Justice Robert Wilentz from an Abbott decision in 1990 in which he documents both the effects of extreme racial isolation on poor children in urban districts and the impact on the state of a kind of disintegration, as he calls it. The Civil Rights Project report made clear to me the situation has dramatically worsened in the intervening years since 1990. Quickly, as to recommendations, using magnet schools, especially regional transfer and magnet plan schools, but with integration goals and civil rights policies, and I agree with Gary that Connecticut and Bridgeport are really interesting and germane models. Secondly, to require that any state-supported choice plan have explicit and enforceable provisions for racial and socioeconomic diversity, and it probably would be an enormous benefit if they had funding incentives to encourage districts to participate in choice that would enhance racial and socioeconomic diversity. Third, venturing a little bit afield, that no government agency should support the construction of lower moderate income housing in apartheid or intensely segregated neighborhoods. And for those who know New Jersey and New Jersey law, that's really the Mount Laurel housing principle, that affordable housing should be located throughout the state to encourage racial and socioeconomic diversity. Fourth, that all state and local legislation, regulations, and policies should be strictly reviewed to ensure that they promote, not impede, racial and socioeconomic diversity. And in my view, that's not just a nice throwaway. That has to have real substance. And finally, school district consolidation, perhaps even a pilot of a countywide school district, should be employed to achieve greater racial and socioeconomic diversity, as well as greater fiscal and educational efficiency. The report, I think, suggests that Essex County could be the best candidate for a pilot because of its extreme segregation and its compact size. Finally, just a word about the prospects that these kinds of recommendations could be adopted. I realize that Governor Christie, Commissioner Cerf, and I agree on one thing, that fundamental, perhaps even radical reform is required to upgrade urban education to a level that will afford the 290,000 students in New Jersey's poor urban districts a high-quality education that will enable them to be productive citizens, carrying their full share of the state's burdens and enjoying a full share of the state's rewards. Make no mistake, the Christie-Cerf reform agenda is a radical one, involving long-term state operation of the largest urban districts, labeling of urban schools as, quote, failure factories, closing failing schools and replacing them with experimental programs, reducing the role of teachers' unions and the job security of teachers, evaluating teachers based on student tests and rewarding teachers with merit pay, and promoting publicly funded voucher programs for parochial schools. The ELP report's reform agenda is hardly more radical, and I would suggest in closing there are two major differences between the Christie-Cerf agenda and the IELP agenda. First, the IELP agenda is constitutionally mandated, and the Christie-Cerf agenda is constitutionally suspect. Secondly, the IELP agenda is evidence-based, and the Christie Surf agenda ignores or defies the best evidence. I could elaborate on the last point if there's interest among those listening, but I'll pass the baton now to James Harris, who's the state president of the NAACP.
Thank you very much, Paul. I want to thank Gary, Greg, and Paul, the New Jersey NAACP, of course, in concert with the national NAACP, has always cared a great deal about equal educational opportunity. And so we always reflect back to Brown versus Board of Education, in which those nine white judges concluded after hearing from Thurgood Marshall and Kenneth Clark that separate was inherently unequal. So it's very, very concerning to us, both at the state level as well as the national, that we see a resegregation, even in some places where we had some decent integration right after the Supreme Court decision. What is troubling in New Jersey is the deep concentration of race and poverty in so few areas of the state. And what this deep segregation has led to is all of those things that represent social ills. We're talking about low educational achievement, high unemployment, the infestation of drugs, guns, and gangs in our urban centers. I believe I would summarize the situation in New Jersey as being particularly troubling because I simply do not see the political will on the part of anyone in the state. The governor and Chris Cerf most certainly has talked about radical reform, but in all instances, the reform that's talked about seems to be targeted at disadvantaging the urban communities even more than they are now. The notion of vouchers, which talk about taking a few kids out of what is agreed on failing schools and putting them into what is perceived as very well-performing private or public schools, always speak to the fact that we're taking black children out of black and Latino children out of urban schools, putting them into white schools that would leave these students still in very racially isolated situations. I'm particularly impressed with the proposals that have been generated by these significant reports that talk about possibilities. I believe that political will and civic responsibility goes hand in hand. And so the NAACP is working very hard to get the parents and the people who live in these communities where education is at such low performance to get more politically involved in putting pressure on our elected officials. Although the problem is magnified when you look at the political representation of race in terms of the segregation of schools, overwhelmingly our white legislators live at such distance from the apartheid schools that sometimes I believe they really have difficulty understanding the significant adverse impact that these schools have, not only on the students and the communities, but on the economic security and advantage of the state of New Jersey. So the NAACP is extremely appreciative to these reports at this time, and we believe that we must strengthen our advocacy to make sure that the resources are targeted and some type of strategic plan. I do agree, since I live in Essex County, is that given the population and the existence of the apartheid schools and the geographics of a reasonably small area, that some pilot programs could prove to be very useful. But I thank Adrian Sanders, who is our Education Committee Chair and who has served as the president or a member of the Asbury Park Board of Education for some time, can speak to her particular focus that we've been doing in New Jersey around school desegregation and equal educational opportunity. Adrian?
Hi, good morning, everyone. First off, I would like to thank Paul, Gary, and Greg for this report, very comprehensive report. You know, many schools serving African Americans and Latinos are detached from advancing educationally because of the racial, social, and economic segregation that really stems from, as the speakers before me have stated, to this high concentration of the poor, namely African Americans and Latinos, in certain areas. And we also know that there is a direct correlation of that to the widening achievement gap that we see based on test scores between African American students and other races, such as Asians and Caucasians. So from the standpoint of the NAACP, we can only see this as a major civil rights issue. And for the state of New Jersey, they need to focus on desegregating schools instead of the formation of charter schools and issuing vouchers to a select number of students. You know, to continue to focus on charter schools would only continue to defy the Constitution, and it would only continue to allow this level of segregation to continue to exist in New Jersey. So therefore, you know, the New Jersey State Conference of the NAACP is in favor of looking at this with our national office to institute an investigation to try to make sure that the state of New Jersey enforces the Constitution and begins to start desegregating these school districts to put an end to these apartheid conditions.
Well, thank you very much. The floor is open for questions from anybody who's listening in.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone now. You'll hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has already been answered and you would like to withdraw registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. And if you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. Once again, ladies and gentlemen on the phone lines, if you'd like to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone now. One moment, please, while we wait for our first question. Our first question comes from the line of Leslie Brody. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for doing this call. I had a question about the vouchers, please. You know, aside from the funding issue, when Mr. Harris said that vouchers would take black and Latino students and put them in white schools where they would still be racially isolated, isn't that what one of the inter-district choice programs that you're recommending would do as well? Can you clarify how the inter-district program would be different? I mean, I know vouchers are for private schools, but just in terms of the racial makeup of the schools that some of the urban children would be going to, how would it be different?
You know, I could.
Paul, you want to address that?
Yeah, well, I can start. I think my understanding of what James was suggesting is that there are really kind of two layers of segregation. One is the layer that the reports primarily address, which is at the school level, where we have schools that are segregated. But I think if I heard James right, he was really adverting to a second layer, which is even if you desegregate, racially balance, diversify a school, you still have to be mindful of the potential that within that school there will be segregation. And, you know, we see it in some New Jersey districts that do focus on trying to be diverse, but have a problem when it comes to some form of ability grouping. Special education in some places is dominated by minorities in certain of the classifications. So, I mean, James can speak very well for himself as to whether that's what he meant. I mean, I do think we want to move Black and Latino kids out into the suburbs, and we want to move white suburban kids and Asian suburban kids into the city. That's really the Connecticut model that Gary had adverted to. But I think, as I understood James' point, it was, and that's not the end of the task. You also have to ensure that they are in diverse educational settings on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, Leslie, for example, you're in Bergen County. Let's talk about Fairlawn, for example, in Kennedy High School. If we take, theoretically, 100 kids in Kennedy East Side, which is overwhelmingly an apartheid school, and we wanted we take the governor's model or Chris Smith's model and says, okay, we're going to allow these five of these 100 students to go to Fairlawn. Well, now you got five students from Fairlawn sitting in a class of possibly 90% white students. But what do we do with the rest of the kids who are left, the other 95 kids who are left at the Eastside High School at Kennedy? They're still in very segregated environments, and there's no proposal where we're talking about truly integrating schools, even across we're talking about based on available seats. Well, Fairlawn's not sitting there with enough seats so that half of the class or 25% of the class or even 15% of the class would be constituted of African-American or Latino students from Eastside High School. So we still have a deep level of segregation and not true integration. Does that help with your question?
We also have done a look at vouchers and inter-district exchanges across the country, and you know a lot of the vouchers don't lead to any integration. They lead to going to another segregated private school. Most private schools that are really competitive and strong schools don't really accept voucher students. So you end up with oftentimes relatively weak private schools or former parochial schools that are themselves segregated getting vouchers. The inter-district exchanges, there's about 8 of them that have been done across the country, tend to make it possible for students to go to really good public schools, because we have plenty of excellent public schools. They just have almost no access for poor kids and African-American kids. And so we've had those for almost 50 years in places like Boston, and we've had some very large experiments in places like St. Louis. Lives change. Their graduation rates go way up. Their college going rates soar. And, you know, we have good public schools that are nearby that often have space. And, you know, why not make that available? We don't have to go to private schools to offer these options. We have good public schools. We just don't allow most disadvantaged kids any access to them. And those students who are in those schools out in the richer suburbs and so forth have no opportunity to learn how to deal with issues of racial and class diversity, which if they're going to go to elite colleges, they have to. Our college, UCLA, which has more applicants than any other college in the United States, is predominantly non-white in four major racial groups. Harvard, when I was teaching there, had 42% non-white students. Students aren't going to be well prepared for those excellent colleges if they grow up in a suburban school system that's totally segregated, where they have no idea how to work with or cross racial and ethnic lines.
Thanks. You know, I just judging by some of the reactions we've had with districts, regional districts here that have broken up because one town's parents don't really want to deal with another town's families, it's hard to see a lot of embracing of some of these ideas.
Well, I think for the NAACP, it goes to the core mission of our organization. We're talking about racial segregation, racial discrimination, and racial hatred. The fact of the matter is we need to come to grips with the fact that human beings are human beings, and parents share common values about what they want for their children. And if we focus more on the common interests of parents all over the world, we want the very best of opportunities and future for our children. And if we could get away from looking at racial groups as being less than rather than having a common motivation and aspiration, maybe the political will come along. But I think the conversation in New Jersey, and particularly the way it's being promoted by our current administration, is to encourage people to believe that segregation is okay and discrimination, while not publicly discussed, is tacitly endorsed.
You know, one of the things is what happens before and after a change. You know, nobody was working or advocating for the change in Connecticut until the issue was brought into the court and the state constitution was activated and people were forced to think of some positive ways to do this, and they managed to create some regional magnet schools that are just extremely popular with all racial groups. So it's not a controversy anymore, except if your kid can't get in. You know, you can create new possibilities that have very positive dimensions. Take some imagination and some a little political courage to put some money out to make that happen. But, you know, there are models of doing this that are very popular.
So are there any plans to take this issue to the court in New Jersey again? And where would that be?
Well, let me weigh in. I mean, one of the elements of these ongoing discussions that representatives of the NAACP and a variety of other groups have had is whether there's a resort to the courts that might be necessary to either win judicial, you know, gain a positive judicial order, or at least change the agenda for public discussion. Because I agree with you, the public climate instinctively is not one that would welcome these kinds of recommendations. On the other hand, I think it is possible to make inroads into that public climate. I'm on the phone from Toronto where I'm visiting, and I have to say, although Ontario is not free of some of the same issues, it's at a much lower order, and there's a much broader public consensus about the essentiality of equal educational opportunity and diversity. Not always implemented 100%, but it's light years different than what exists in New Jersey, most of New Jersey, and for that matter, most of the U.S. And I think we have some really serious thinking to do, you know, as we move in New Jersey toward being a so-called majority-minority state. We just can't keep bottling up the problem, building the walls high enough to keep the issues on the other side of the wall. You know, that's why I think the Chief Justice Wilentz quote is so interesting. Almost 25 years ago, he says the isolation and disintegration of urban communities can't be cabined in. It will affect the whole state. And he was at that point saying, well, soon we'll be one-third minority population. Well, we're soon going to be one-half minority population. And if we couldn't cabin in the problems when it was less than a third, we surely can't cabin them in when it's approaching a half. So I think we're going to have to confront some hard realities, and hopefully that will result in some changes in the public climate and the political climate.
And to chime in on that, you know, in the state of New Jersey, the governor has indicated that he has strong interest in changing the composition of a court so that perhaps decisions and policies of the court, like Mount Laurel and thorough and efficient, can be eliminated or changed through the judicial process. NAACP's position is that most of the laws about discrimination and requiring integration and fairness have been hard to win in the first place. So we have no patience or interest in seeing a diminished enforcement of those laws that were supposed to be in the interest of the public, and most certainly a great social and political educational impact. So when we look at constitutional things that don't get addressed, we would prefer to negotiate and have conversations, but we've had as much success through litigation as we have through other mechanisms. So that always has to be part of our consideration.
Well, if you file any suits, please let me know. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Our next question comes from the line of Julie Dario. Please go ahead.
Hi, yes. I was interested in what you said about the possibility of a pilot program in Essex County, considering the segregation issues in that area and also the size of the county. What would a pilot program in Essex look like?
Well, I live in Montclair, which is one of the most racially integrated communities, with a nationally recognized model of public schools called the magnet schools. But I live right next door to East Orange, which is 98% one of the apartheid schools. If you go 10 minutes north, you're into Livingston in West Essex. It wouldn't take a whole lot of transportation. It wouldn't take a whole lot of sharing of resources and personnel to get those schools in the western part of Essex County to have access for those children from Newark, Irvington, East Orange, and Orange. We bus people all over this country, so it's not the bus that's bothering people. It's us who's on those buses. But Essex County is small enough so that you could move students within reasonably short distances to schools. But the other piece that I think is very, very important to understand, I think if Chris Christie had his children enrolled in a school in Newark, East Orange, or Irvington, he'd have great interest in that school being improved significantly right away.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay, just wanted to make sure. Well, one of the things that you mentioned, you know, using the expression busing and desegregation in schools, I mean, that kind of immediately has a trigger considering the issues that arose with that, in, you know, in the 70s. I'm wondering how, I guess you would almost sell this to parents, because you mentioned before that there's the concern that you want to look at this issue as all parents having a common goal to get their children the best education, but the issue of desegregating and using busing systems definitely has historical implications. So how would this be different, and how would you get around that that trigger?
Could I come in on this?
Sure.
I wrote a book called Must We Bus? this, you know, the major so-called busing orders, which is a term invented by George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama, happened in the 1970s. Since 1980, almost all desegregation plans have been based on choice. They're not assigning students, mandating that they go from one school to another. They're expanding the choices of students within a framework that produces diversity. Magnet schools were characteristic of that, and magnet schools are still our largest choice system in the United States and very popular in many places. The Obama administration briefly in its first year put out a little money for expanding magnet schools, and there was an incredible amount of interest around the country. So we're not talking about busing in the sense that was mandatory transfer of students. We're talking about choice with civil rights policies attached to it that foster diversity and stability. So we're talking about expanding the options for parents and giving them an opportunity to be in a in a school that offers new educational possibilities and the advantages of diversity, which almost every college in the United States has accepted as an educationally valuable experience, the experience of diversity. So, you know, this is not the same issue. And certainly people will try to make it into the same issue, but it isn't. It's about expanding choice and creating a possibility for an experience of a stable diversity with better educational options. And that's a very different reality, although often people stereotype it as being the same thing.
Yeah. Let me also...
I do want to say this. Even when we, I mean, busing has had Cook on a very inflammatory reference because of the desegregation of schools in the South. But I do, we've got towns in New Jersey where integration is not an issue. It's about getting kids from a school, one school to the other. So I'm not using it as a negative term. If there's a good school in parts of the town that the child happens not to live in, the issue is transporting the student from one place to the other to get to the good school. But what's important is every school has to be of such high quality that some parents want their children to be in those schools.
Most American students are bused to school. Nobody objects except when it's related to mandatory desegregation.
Exactly.
Let me also weigh in. Let me make Julia. Was the name Julia or Juliet?
Julie, yeah.
Julie. Just three kind of diverse points. One, back in the 60s or 70s, there was a voluntary cross-district program in Essex County in which the Verona School District accepted a number of students from Newark who were bused to Verona, and the program existed for a number of years, not because anybody ordered it, but because actually Verona thought it would be an important positive for its students to have that kind of cross-racial, cross-cultural, cross-economic line experience. Secondly, and this is a story I very much want to tell, there's a district in Morris County called the Morris School District, which almost nobody knows about, which was a creation of, the state Supreme Court and the Commissioner of Education. It was a forced consolidation of Morristown, an urban district, and Morris Township, a surrounding white suburban district, for racial balance reasons. They just celebrated their 40th anniversary as a consolidated district. It's probably the most diverse school district in New Jersey. It sends 93% of its kids on to higher education. It's been the salvation of Morristown as a county seat. And that's a story nobody tells. The third, which is relevant to the notion of a countywide school district, is that in the latest U.S. News and World Report rankings of high schools in New Jersey, 5 of the top 10 high schools in New Jersey are run by county vocational districts. And I read that and I said, wow, how did that happen? Well, they're magnet schools. They attract kids all over the county. They have a countywide catchment area for students instead of a small municipal catchment area, and they have produced remarkably good high-tech schools that are sending 100% of their students on to college, often to places like Caltech and MIT. So it struck me that maybe there's something in this idea of a larger district, let alone the craziness of New Jersey's 617 undersized school districts, which, you know, blue ribbon commissions for the last 60 years have been saying this is crazy. We need to create a more rational and efficient system of delivering education. And so I think there's a lot, if people get beyond the initial rhetoric, you know, well, if it involves busing, it's bad, and look at some of the realities both of education and economic matters, I think ideas that seem really far out and unacceptable start looking pretty appealing.
Okay, thank you very much for your responses.
You're welcome.
And there are no further questions at this time.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody very much for participating, and if you want to get more information on these reports, you can find them on the website of the Civil Rights Project, civilrightsproject.ucla.edu, and on the website of the Institute. Paul, what is it?
It's really very simple. It's ielp.rutgers.edu.
Thanks to everybody.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.
Thank you.